Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. So the last thing I just wanted to mention from the Turner piece, another factor which can increase the likelihood that what is called like a social disturbance will be viewed as a protest rather than mere deviance and mere rebellion. I think this, your example of the water protectors at Standing Rock, is a great contrast here. And probably the biggest difference is just, and he puts it this way, the magnitude of the threat that the protest or social disturbance represents. In other words, if the threat is too high, right, if there's too much violence and there's a real threat to social order, then it will be interpreted as rebellion or revolution, and that's really scary. But if it's not scary enough, then it's easy to dismiss it as being mere deviance or frivolous or whatever. Whereas if there is a bit of a threat, people are more likely to take it seriously. Certainly, it helps with getting coverage on the news as well. So this is an interesting case where, and now we're kind of getting into the question of whether violence can actually help the cause of a protest. It's a case where, the destruction of property and disorderliness and those kinds of things can actually make people take it more seriously. And not just take it more seriously as a threat, but actually take it to be more legitimate. Perhaps just because it forces them to wrestle with it more explicitly than if they can be easily dismissed.
Well, so one other kind of little wrinkle here is an important distinction between violence in protest and civil obedience and lawbreaking in protest and civil disobedience. It's sort of an assumption that all violence is unlawful, and so that's part of the reason for why we think that protests that engage in violence are somehow bad, because this kind of legal stuff starts coming in. I say that because if somebody is merely acting illegally, you don't need to take them seriously, right? Because they're just vandals. They're breaking stuff. They're setting things on fire, whatever it is they're doing. An alternative to violence as a way of drawing legitimacy to protest comes from Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. And you guys can fill in the history on this for me. I read this for the first time in 2013, in my first 6 months in the States. Honestly, it would have been in my first 2 months in the States, because I had to start teaching in an ethics class. And one of the pieces we were teaching was Martin Luther King's letter to a Birmingham jail. And in much the same way that, no, we don't celebrate Thanksgiving in not America, we also typically don't read founding. They've also got their own Thanksgiving.
Well, yeah, it's Canadian, not American Thanksgiving. Yeah, it's close enough.
Anyway, it's not necessarily canon anywhere else, so I might be a little bit rusty on the details. Anyway, so King he outlines in this letter the four steps for civil disobedience and outlining the sort of philosophy behind nonviolent protest for him. And I think Michael's going to tell us a bit about the relationship between like this King, maybe some later King, and Malcolm X, but I'll leave the American to fill that in. Anyway, King is in jail. Not because of violence, but for intentionally breaking a protesting without a license law. So this was very intentionally part of the tactics, right? For King to engage in an action that broke the law that was not as severe as the kinds of unjust actions that he was protesting against, namely, lynching, killing of black people, redlining, exclusion, everything that fueled the civil rights movement, far more egregious, morally egregious actions than engaging in a protest that is legally unsanctioned, right? Not getting the permit.
Not doing the paperwork.
Not doing the paperwork to get a permit. But he did that in order to, partly as a demonstration to get what he calls the moral high ground, by showing that, look, I'm going to put some skin in the game here. And I'm going to break a law intentionally, that's not as bad, right, as a part of my civil obedience, my causing unrest in our society, to draw attention to this greater cause.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, it sounds like, he would at least at the time of that letter, very much disagree with what I just mentioned from Turner, because his strategy, as you said, first of all, is nonviolent, but it's like radically nonviolent. Like, so first of all, you know, before you engage in civil disobedience, and we're just talking about breaking really uninteresting, boring laws that no one cares about most of the time anyways, it's first of all meant to be done as a last resort, right? You have to pursue your normal avenues of democratic change and blah, 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 right? He had done that without any traction, so he was forced to resort to civil disobedience. And then, you know, the basic strategy was, first of all, there was an expectation that when you march or you engage in a sit-in in those circumstances, you will probably be attacked physically and verbally. And when you are attacked, you do not retaliate. And that is a, in my view, a pretty, it's the standard of a saint. It's an inhuman, very difficult standard to meet, which was met. But anyways, his idea was, right, he was very much concerned about the other side of this, whereas if you retaliate, it's very easy for the police and the media to paint you as deviants, as criminals, as, you know, subhuman, whatever. Whereas if you don't retaliate, you exhibit your incredible humanity to the point where people have this really difficult
creative tension.
Yeah, creative tension, right? They can't reconcile the fact that these people are treated the way they are generally, and in that instance of being, say, physically beaten by police or something like that, and they're not retaliating. They seem to be incredible. Why are they being treated this way, right? And that was kind of the strategy. Which is interesting, right? So he's very much going in the other direction and thinking that violence will absolutely undermine his cause. And I suspect that this is partly, that legacy, I think, is partly why a lot of Americans are so ready to accept the principle that violence and protest is unjustified and will undermine the cause.
And it's also a tactic and a way of talking about protest, or it's become a tactic and a way of talking about and delegitimizing protests, by appealing to this very sanitized version of King, which isn't true to the King, but I'm going to let Michael fill that in. I just want to, you know, the idea that violence is never justified and you ought always do this other stuff first, right?
It seems right that the embrace of King is in part by white America post-civil rights was partially intended to then undermine civil rights movements, right? By embracing the whitewashed version of King, white America was then able to set up this impossible standard against which to evaluate every future protest, and thereby delegitimize every future protest, because, as you've noted, it's nearly an impossible standard. The later King certainly is less reluctant to engage in some level of resistance, right? The saintly standard, you know, I don't want to say that he walks back, but he at least acknowledges that white America might not be persuadable through, you know, this saintly sort of perfection that he pursued, right? That even regardless of how good he was and everybody that he organized with was, that still might not be enough to actually convince white America to change its mind and improve.
Yeah, right? I think like the Martin Luther King Jr. as of Letter from Birmingham Jail, that approach is deeply optimistic about white America, right? And that optimism starts to fade.
Right, and that's really the more critical version of King's views about what can be accomplished through pure nonviolent resistance is ripped from the record books, I think, as lots and lots of Black history scholars have explained, in large part just as a tactic of control, right? So that later on, you set up an impossible standard, and then you can delegitimize anything when evaluated against that impossible standard.
Right, so anytime there's any violence or destruction of property, any protest, you appeal to the Letter from Birmingham Jail standard, so you're not meeting that. Therefore, this is illegitimate.
Right. Yeah. So there's that aspect of it that I think is at least worth pointing out. The other historical fact that you have to wrestle with when you're trying to evaluate whether that standard is even, you know, has any hope in the first place, or whether it was really the thing that made the difference is that it's not as though all activists at that time embraced that standard, right? There was a cultural backdrop of people like Malcolm X, right, who were who rejected that standard as not just impossible but foolhardy, right, and thought that violence, or at the very least the threat of violence, was necessary in order to compel a white America that demonstrated no interest in change or revising its beliefs, was just a necessary component to make that possible. And when you're evaluating the historical context of King's political achievements, you have to recognize that. So this is laid out really nicely in Howard Pitney's book on American Jeremiads and African-American appeals to justice. And what he lays out in there, which, is all of this is obviously has a massive scholarship behind it and controversial, but one sort of lesson in his chapter on Malcolm X is that the embrace of Martin Luther King Jr. only occurred, or at least for a lot of Black scholars and historians think it only really occurred because you had the backdrop and you had the alternative, which was Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam and a more militant resistance to the oppression that existed, right? And so when we try to evaluate the historical efficacy of that sort of saintly approach to affecting change, like just in the context of what Martin Luther King Jr. achieved, you have to look at all of the aid that was provided by people like Malcolm X, whose threats played a pretty significant role in getting white America to recognize that if you don't embrace Martin Luther King, or at least listen to him, your alternative is for the civil rights movement to then most likely be taken over by people like Malcolm X, right? And so those threats played a pretty significant role in getting the American population to actually pay attention to Martin Luther King Jr. And in that way, it's true that the message and the standard that Martin Luther King Jr. set for himself was this saintly nonviolent standard, but it's not necessarily the case that it was pure saintliness and that impossible standard that actually led to, white America listening.
Yeah, what's really interesting too is if you put this in a different context and you ask people, if some sort of villainous, corrupt person attacks you and you are, engaging in some kind of peaceful protest, do you think that you can defend yourself with violence, right? As self-defense typically requires some kind of violence against an attacker to defend yourself. I would guess they would say overwhelmingly, of course. Of course you can. But not only that, you could see where someone could make the argument that there's something almost demeaning. I'm not saying that this is the case for King, and it gets complicated when you bring in sort of like religious values. But you could see someone like Malcolm X arguing that it's demeaning to let yourself be abused by corrupt police, for instance. And that dignity requires, actually, you're morally obligated to fight back, which is seems pretty plausible.
Right. And that's, and again, in Pitney's book, that is an important observation made about the role of Malcolm X, is that the kind of militant resistance that X advocated was a essential part of Black Americans reclaiming some sense of dignity in an oppressive state that tried to rip that away from them, right? And the militancy and that the aggressive resistance was an essential part of that. And so there's a sort of an intrinsic value to actually participating in that kind of resistance.
There's a kind of parallel here to work in arrogance and humility. So there's been a lot of attention over the last few years within philosophy, also some interdisciplinary research areas on this idea of intellectual humility. And this is in part because of the way that public discourse has been going in the US on a range of, pick a political issue, right? You could put insert almost any of them into this this kind of discussion, where we have this sort of seemingly, and here I'm just going to steal Michael Lynch's pitch for the Humility and Conviction Project. We have this seemingly deep conflict between two civic values in the States, humility and conviction. And trying to balance humility and conviction is incredibly difficult. Now, if we're thinking about people being open-minded and reasonable and rational, we're inclined to say that people ought to be humble and that there's a real concern of arrogance, where we take arrogance to be people who are unwilling to change their minds. They're angry. They're combative. They're not charitable. They're not going to think that they have anything to learn from other people. And that the ideal is this humble standard. But there's been a lot of concern over the last probably only 2 or 3 years that demanding humility from everybody actually occludes a demand for certain people, marginalized persons and minorities, to be servile. And servility is a kind of diffident passiveness, which really robs you of what is good at the heart of that idea of conviction, right? You should stand up for what you believe in. You should care about it. You should be willing to fight for it. You should be willing to defend it. So there is some concern, I guess, and this is bound up in these ideas about dignity, standing up for your rights, being willing to break laws, take some punishment for yourself, being willing to engage in some acts of, you know, property destruction or something like that to bring attention to the cause, that actually might get us more around what a genuine kind of humility is, right? With a respect for self and an openness and a willingness to listen to others, provided that they're also on the same page. So the concerns about pride, I think, do share this kind of vice aspect with the civility concerns, demanding that everybody has to shut up and listen to everybody else, right? That's not really where we want to go. And the idea that you couldn't do something to defend your basic human rights and your basic human needs by physically acting out in some circumstances, I think rightly sounds to some people like asking them to give up on themselves and giving up on defending themselves. And it's a very powerful tactic for those in power who tend to only err on the arrogant side of the spectrum, to fail to acknowledge the civility that they have demanded from those on the other side, and to not take seriously the fact that they're rendering certain people passive and servile and unable to assert themselves.
All right, so let's start talking about whether or not violent protests can be justified. And maybe we start by just considering a simple argument against it. And we've already kind of touched on this, and the answer probably pretty obvious, but I think there's more to say. And the argument would just be like, well, violent protests, except when it involves self-defense, will almost necessarily involve lawbreaking. And all things being equal, you shouldn't break the law. So don't do that. Or more specifically, right, you have a maybe you say we all have a civic obligation not to break the law. And, you know, we expect everyone else to follow the laws, and this puts obligations on us to do the same. So it's wrong for that reason. I mean, this should already sound absurd, but I'll let you guys.
Well, there are different responses, right? There are different responses. So the Martin Luther King as a natural law theorist response is an unjust law is no law at all. Which is that Aquinas originally? It's one of the A's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's Quine.
It's one of the A's.
Oh, you know, there's
Augustine, Aquinas.
Augustine, Aquinas. Sometimes Agrippa just pops up in my head, sure, too. And I'm just like, no, it's definitely not that one, but he comes along for the ride. Anyway. So if an unjust law isn't a law at all, then you can't break the law by refusing to act in accordance with it. It's simply not a law. The kind of surface level idea here is that laws are naturally occurring either by the power of God or something else. And just like how we try to discover physical laws and we can be wrong about those, some of the laws that we have governing our society are just misguided or wrong. And King has some details. Letter from Birmingham Jail has some of these in there for kind of like litmus tests for when a law might be an unjust law, which we won't go into. But like, that's one response you could give here, right? It's not illegal to break an unjust law because an unjust law isn't a law.
Or the other way you can go is just like, it's illegal, but it has no moral force. It's not morally binding if it's unjust.
Right.
Those will basically be equivalent. So I think that's a really good starting point, and it will help us complicate the situation a little bit, right? Because what's interesting, if that's going to, you know, if this response is going to justify violent protest, or if it's going to justify lawbreaking, it justifies the breaking of the laws that are unjust. And I'm thinking here of Tommy Shelby's piece, or his book, Dark Ghettos. He has a piece, I think it's called Justice Deviance in the Dark Ghetto, where he argues that the ghetto poor, because the basic structure is so deeply unjust and is so oppressive to them, don't have obligations of reciprocity to respect the law. And in particular, you know, this might be like property laws, like petty theft or something like that. And it could be that the property laws themselves are unjust, or at least they're an important part of their oppression. So you could identify that law as unjust and you could break it. A more toy case would be like, or not even a toy case, an unjustly imposed curfew, I think, is a good case, right? You could protest against that law if it were unjust by going out too late past the curfew, right? And so you would be directly breaking that law, which isn't binding on you because it's unjust. What's a little bit more complicated here is that in the cases we're considering, the protest is about police brutality and at least isn't directly obviously related to like the property laws, which protect the goods of stores from looters, right? So it's interesting, right? That defense will only get you so far and probably won't get you to a defense of the kinds of cases that we're interested in, because a different law, which for, you know, we can argue about, but for the purposes of this argument, we'll treat as being just, let's say, is being broken in the name of protesting a different kind of policy, and not even a law, but, you know.
So, yeah, this is where I would talk about Hobbes, but it gets complicated very fast. Because there are a couple different ways I could talk about it. It seems like the arguments, the responses that say, look, we don't have civil obligations to respect the laws because of some institutional failure, can take a variety of forms, and it really depends on your background theory of state legitimacy, right? Like the reciprocity arguments that you just gave assume a certain sort of Rawlsian perspective on what legitimizes institutional authority. Immediately when Hannah started talking about natural law theory, Hobbes popped into my head as a different kind of natural law theorist who's, you know, the Leviathan is meant to defend the state's authority over individuals on the grounds of a kind of natural law theory, where for Hobbes, the starting point is that the natural law is that human beings will and should do whatever it is that protects their life, right? And that's sort of the starting point for everything for Hobbes. And, you know, then immediately you go, okay, well, so should I respect the authority of the state? And Hobbes says, absolutely, because as long as the state's in position to, and create conditions of security for you, then the state has this critical role to play. And so you should respect the authority of the state. And anything you do that undermines that goes against the natural law. And the obvious reply in cases like those under consideration right now is, yeah, but what if that's not the state's relationship to me? Right? What if the state doesn't protect my life and promote my life? What if it's actually the state is the primary threat to my life? And what if that's my relationship to the state? Then is it the case that the natural law dictates that I have to respect the state authority? And I think Hobbes in various places basically acknowledges, yeah, no, that doesn't actually follow from my view, right? If the state really is purely a threat to your life, then you don't have an obligation to respect the state's authority. And this isn't just for specific laws, right? But in general, it's a way of challenging the overall legitimacy of the state and your general civic obligations to respect the state, right? So, of course, it gets complicated when are your actions actually violations of the state's authority versus actions that are, you know, some other kind of civic engagement that isn't challenging the state's authority or violating the state's authority. And of course, things get really complicated on Hobbes' view because moral obligations only exist under the threat of the state on Hobbes' view. We can set that aside as not something that we necessarily want to worry about. But I think, you know, the point here is the degree to which you on under these various theories have an obligation to respect the state's authority and actually abide by its laws depend critically on your relationship to the state. And obviously, for a lot of Black Americans, it is not the case that the state, their relationship to the state is one where they feel like the state is a protector of their life, right? And that's exactly what these protests are about, is expressing that that is not the relationship they have to the state. And under those conditions, it seems like under these theories, it's hard to make the case that one has a civic obligation to then just abide by the laws of a government, or that there's any kind of moral force, as you said earlier, behind the state's laws.
It might be useful for me to just have some examples of the kinds of violence that we're talking about. Because Michael, as you're saying, right, that argument seems to work for actions against the state. So burning a police precinct, burning police cars might count, because those are state property, right? Those are state objects, and so you're damaging their property as a direct way to get your message across to them. Probably groups toppling and or defacing Confederate statues is another kind of example of the actions that have been taken in these protests. We heard a lot more about that in, you know, around the 2015-2016 Black Lives Matter protests, where there was a lot of statue toppling taking place. But then there are other acts of violence that also happen during protests, like stores that are owned by individuals, right? Just other members of the society, right? That aren't government property. And that, I think, I mean, that's where the media likes to put, sort of drive a wedge on protests, right? To be fair, they do also take the toppling of Confederate monuments a lot of times to be illegitimate, but definitely, and in the current round of protests, the attention has really been on individual store owners whose stores, you know, mum and pop shops that have been damaged in these protests. And that's really the kind of violent action that at least the media has been drawing attention to. So I guess one question about, because the Hobbes very much makes us think about this in terms of the state and a citizens versus state issue. And it's not clear to me that we should understand Black Lives Matter protests that way. Certainly it's about police brutality. That is a thing that's really important. But white complicity is also really important. And so, I mean, is that how we can understand the role of violence or property damage, that's not directly targeting the state, but is also being a productive part of these protests, right? It's like, you know, because it's not just about the state, right? It's about the whole system. It's about how we keep rolling over these issues, how we keep not supporting change on these issues. And that's where anything that appeals to the state and the law to justify that kind of burning gives you that kind of citizens versus state framing. But that's not always what we're talking about.
Yeah. I tried to zoom out in the discussion, right, and say, like, just here first is the Hobbesian sort of view, right? And then I tried to backpedal to our social institutions, right, which are not just exclusively about the state. And I think, I mean, we'll get into this, but I think the obvious way to analyze some of the cases that you gave is exactly along the lines of what you said, right, which is clearly, you know, Black Lives Matter, as you've noted, is not just about resisting the state, but really a wide, you know, a wide variety of social institutions and practices that all together are create the conditions of oppression that Black people live under. And I think the general point I was trying to make was that your obligation, your civic obligations ultimately depend on your relationship to those various social institutions. And possibly the most straightforward way to understand at least some of the cases where people are destroying property as resistance to those social institutions, right? Or as you said, white complicity. So when if you are damaging buildings or property of institutions or people who are clearly complicit, right, in your oppression, right, then there's a clear sense in which the target there is somebody that you're intending to express something to politically about your relationship to them and their role in the creation of the institutions that are responsible for your oppression, right? It gets tough when you're talking about, you know, small businesses and mom and pop businesses, but there are clearly, you know, easier examples, right? Like when people target banks that are responsible for redlining and things like that, then I think it's clearer that the level of complicity and the degree of complicity is very easy to identify, as this institution has played a direct role in creating these conditions, right? And obviously these things come in degrees, right? So banks that are explicitly adopting redlining policies are complicit, are extremely complicit. Mom and pop shops are almost certainly complicit to a large extent as well, but not to the same degree, right, as you know, the banking institutions that adopt those policies, right? So these are obviously things that come in degrees, but I think you're right. And what I meant to say is just the institutions that people are in relation to determine their civic obligations, and it very much depends on like what you think the foundations of justice are that determine your obligations under those various relations.
So I think there was a paper by Avia Pasternak, which I thought was really helpful in sorting through these issues, and which will take us away from discussions about civic obligations and political philosophy. Right, because if you like, take the Shelby line, for instance, and you just say, look, there isn't a civic obligation to obey certain laws, what he does say is it doesn't follow that therefore destruction and violence is permissible because you have separate moral obligations to your fellows, right, who are the owners of the property or who are being harmed. And so to justify destruction and violence, you need more than just that there's no civic obligation that obtains. And what she points out is that we can really usefully take advantage of the tools of just war theory, which is, you know, concerns when it's permissible to engage in war, which will necessarily involve harming other people, harming people who are complicit, and probably harming people who are relatively innocent. It does turn out we do think that, you know, engaging in defensive justified wars is a permissible thing. All right. So there is a case where we do think that destruction and violence, potentially on a large scale, can be justified. And she points out that, you know, what she refers to as political rioting, but it's very similar to what we're talking about when we're talking about violent protest. She points out that there's a really strong analog there, right, where there's a group of people that are more or less under attack or being threatened by something. In the case of war, it's obvious. You can think of an invading army. In the case of the protesters, they are threatened and attacked by the particular injustice, in this case, police brutality. And then the question is, or the situation is one where the only way they can avoid, let's say, invasion, being taken over, or being killed, is by inflicting in certain defensive harms, right? So harms you inflict in self-defense to protect yourself against either an injustice or an invading army. And so she points out that, you know, given this analog, we can maybe appeal to the tools of just war theory and the conditions under which engaging in warfare and violence is justified, and maybe apply it to the case of political protest, and then we can get an answer to when it's justifiable. So as she points out, there's generally taken to be three conditions on just warfare for the permissibility of warfare. One is that it's necessary, right? Is this the only practical recourse for avoiding some military conflict, let's say, or avoiding the injustice of police brutality? The second condition is a success condition. Is the defensive harm that you're going to engage in, perhaps destroying a police station, or engaging in looting or something like that, is it more likely to work? Is it likely to make the protest successful? And by extension, is it likely to help you avoid the particular harm you're protesting against, namely injustice and brutality from police? And then finally, a proportionality constraint, which is the defensive harm proportional to the harm that the attack will inflict? Now, if we apply those to this case, the necessity condition seems clearly fulfilled, right? The normal democratic means for enacting police reform, there's been some successes, but it's very slow and it's not good enough, right? So you could argue that these protests are more or less necessary. Though the question of whether the violent part is necessary kind of depends on how effective that is, which you've already kind of discussed. Right, then the question is the violence actually, does it enhance the cause of the protesters? We've given some reason for thinking that yes, perhaps it does, though of course there are limits. And then finally, if we're asking about proportionality, the question is the injustice being protested against, namely police brutality, equal or greater in magnitude to the harm of the looting and destruction and bodily injury that's occurring? And there, plausibly, yes. We're talking about a pretty massive injustice, and we're talking about pretty minor property damage or property violations and some bodily harm, which is, of course, unfortunate, but relatively minor compared to police brutality.
Though the bodily harm that we're seeing covered is defensive, right? I mean, mostly. It's not like groups of protesters are surrounding police and beating them. That's not what's happening, right? It's so that I don't even want to bring that bodily harm piece in. I think what we're talking about is the destruction of property.
Yeah.
And graffitiing and defacing. Now, eye for an eye, is that equivalent to being beaten and murdered in broad daylight with no consequences for officers? No, it's not proportional, because the latter thing is way worse, right? If anything, if you really wanted this hard, retributivist, it should be equal, or it could approach equality, then we got a lot of room to go before these protests start getting disproportionate in their response to what they're what they're protesting against.
And we can talk about these conditions in more detail. I just wanted to give a quick gloss.
Yeah, because the standing rock can also go through these on those, and the proportionality are the same.
Now, this I think nicely brings out Hannah's initial challenge, which was there's a difference between targeting the state and maybe, again, you would see destroying police property as, let me put it this way. What's interesting, and the way I think this can help with Hannah's initial question, is that you can see this application of just war theory conditions as really an extension of general self-defense principles. And so what's interesting is, if you're talking about police brutality in particular, then you would think self-defense will justify, if we assume that this is going to help prevent further police brutality, violence against that particular entity, the police. So maybe the burning of police cruisers or stations or destruction of police equipment or something like that. There is a case where you are defending yourself against the attacker. But there is a complication that Hannah brought up, which is that in lots of cases, there are people who, yes, they may be complicit to varying degrees, but some people are, if just by accident, the property of people who are also victims of police brutality, who are part of the same communities, will be destroyed, or people who are just generally unrelated to the injustice. What do we say about those cases, right? It's not as easy to see how the self-defense principles will apply. And I think most people, when they think of looting and the destruction of property and protest, will have this kind of response. They're like, this is senseless violence, and it harms innocent people, and that can't be justified. And so I think those are the really challenging cases. I think.
But that's where the just war theory defense really gives us some tools, though, right? Because there are acceptable levels of civilian casualties, at least if you're not a pacifist. And so some civilians get caught up in acts of war, and people take that to be justifiable, right? It's obviously a harm. Nobody's saying that it's not harmful to them. Nobody's saying that it's not legitimate to be upset or angry about it. But when we're talking about it in the context of war, it's an acceptable cost for bringing democracy to this country that doesn't have democracy, or whatever.
You sound like an American.
Human rights. I'm trying. Right? Because that's how people talk about that, right? They put it this purely utilitarian calculus, it's acceptable, da da da. And if it works in that case, and if the analogy is similar enough to these kinds of protest cases, then we've got our defense. If it's not, then we have to tease apart why they're not sufficiently similar, or why the sort of civilian casualties in the protest cases are distinct from the other cases, the war cases.
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, using the just war theory tools, though, it gets complicated really quickly, right? Because, like, yeah, civilian casualties are generally accepted under just war theory, but there are conditions on, like, a requirement that states try to minimize them as much as possible. Any individuals who operate on behalf of the state who intentionally engage in, killing civilians are... while the war itself might be justified, they would be considered sort of illegal actors who need to be held to some form of account for what they've done. So even, this is, we get back to the like composition decomposition problem of trying to talk about justification or legitimacy of this broad social thing. And then the individual, it might be that the individual agents who, or people who, are inflicting the analog of civilian casualties, maybe they're morally culpable. And that's, there's a distinction between saying that those individual actions are justified versus the large or wider protests, which might involve violent actions that happen to, inevitably include some of those incidents being justified, right? Those are like two levels of justification that we have to pull apart. And it gets delicate because then you have to say like, well, maybe it's the case that political protests that turn that involve property damage or violence to some degree are justifiable to a degree, but then within those there are unjustifiable actions that are just clearly unjustified, right? And when you are engaging in the analog of civilian harm, maybe those actions aren't justifiable. So the just war theory tools are.
It's difficult. I do just want to register that Pasternak does, I mean, what she points out does follow from this is like, right, the necessity constraint, right? Is this something you have to do? Does mean that, for instance, or and also like, does it contribute to the success of the cause? Probably killing people does undermine the cause of protests, right? So it does place significant constraints on the kind of violence you could engage in, right? Because it does need to be A, necessary, or you have to have reason at least to think that it's A, necessary, and B, actually helps the just cause. So that is going to put pretty strong constraints on the kinds of things you can do. This is a separate point from the complication you're raising, right. I recognize. Yeah.
Yeah, but back to the complications, I guess two things. One, the just war theory defense argument still stands. All we've shown is that there can be people who are some subset of the group whose actions we were trying to legitimize who are acting in illegitimate ways. So the defense of violence and protest would still stand. But what it also says then is we have to be really granular when we're looking at instances of violence and property destruction to see who was doing it and why. And then that brings us to the rumor mill of the present day, which is we don't know. We do not know who is engaging in looting and rioting. And there's allegations all across. I'm saying we don't know because I have not seen a consensus form around this, right? We've seen everything from it's paramilitary groups to it's the protests to it's white supremacists to it's just teenagers taking advantage of everybody being crazy, right? So we don't know. That's an empirical question. But given that, you know, we're doing the philosophical thing, in principle, can we justify it? We have the defense. What we've got is a description of cases where there are people who, on the face of it, look like they're doing the legitimate thing. Actually, they're taking advantage or they're not acting in accordance with the principles. And that matters, right? Because if everybody engaging in the protest and who was engaging in some sort of property damage wasn't doing so in the ways that are legit because they didn't need to do it that way or something, right? Necessity condition is violated. Then you might be able to say the protest is undermined. If you've just got some bad actors in there who are taking advantage of the situation or not quite lining up with it, that doesn't show that your protest has been undermined, right? So the principle right. would still be upheld.
Just for clarification, Michael, so were you, so Hannah is like distinguishing between, so like one way of interpreting what you're saying and what Hannah is saying is that, look, there are going to be like lots of looters presumably don't have good intentions and don't care about the cause, right? That's just to be expected. There will be human beings that will take advantage of situations when they can, even if that's not most of them or whatever. Is your question or is your thought that you can have lots of instances of that actually do end up promoting the cause sort of incidentally, and therefore you have kind of a justified collective action, even if there's unjustified actions?
No.
Or was your thought that even the people who are well-intentioned, you know, if there are people who are like, I'm going to smash this store because I'm pissed, I thought you were saying that, you know, perhaps you would say that even those are sort of unjustified individual actions, even if on the collective scale they are justified.
So, no, my only... My only claim or the observation I wanted to sort of make was initially we started talking as though just war theory makes room for casualties and civilian casualties, and that you can have a certain amount of that and still be justified. And all I wanted to point out was that's true, but under most just war theories, the people who intentionally engage in the causing of civilian casualties are still morally responsible agents who everybody recognizes should be held to account under just war theory. So if whatever the analog to that is, you can on the one hand say, look, the protests themselves are completely justified. But to be clear, when you're engaging in the analog of civilian casualties, you might be is morally responsible, or you might be morally responsible for that and need to be held to account for that. And that's not to in any way dismiss the protests and their legitimacy, but just that's the, you know, that's the caveat that we have to keep in mind when we're talking about how civilian casualties are an acceptable part of the protest. And then what I wanted to say was, so you might be one of, you know, if you are a well-intentioned protest organizer who knows that there's going to be some legitimate property destruction, right, justifiable property destruction, and you know that there are going to be civilian casualties, in a sense, of people who are misbehaving or engaging in these illicit methods of protest, you can be justified under the just war theory of still organizing the protest, right? In the analog of this, right? You can still think it's morally acceptable as an organizer of this thing that's going to have civilian casualties and not be morally culpable for those civilian casualties. Nevertheless, the people who are responsible for them may actually, you know, they're still responsible for them. They're still, you know, moral complications, right, and consequences that have to be acknowledged as part of that.
So at minimum, the just war discussion thus far will not necessarily vindicate destruction of property or bodily harm, even if it is in the service of, even if it is necessary, even if it does contribute to success, which I think gets us to, there might be an argument which does vindicate that, which is separate, which does come up in this paper and also Tommy Shelby's paper. There's another, it's a really difficult case, I think, in the case of war, and we can ask whether it applies to the case of protest, political protest, and maybe which kinds of cases. But it's a really difficult kind of case where there's like a highly asymmetrical war where you have one army that is just much bigger and more advanced than another. And let's suppose the smaller army, which is on the defensive and their cause is justifiable, let's say they'll be wiped out or at minimum they'll be politically dominated by the invading country. And suppose they have no chance of success and they also cannot actually defend themselves against the military. And really their only way of resisting is by attacking civilians on the other side. That's a really interesting case, I think. Because on the one hand, if you're just running utilitarian calculus, you're like, well, you're screwed anyways. Why ruin additional lives in the process? On the other hand, this is maybe where this idea of dignity comes in again, where you could argue, and this is sort of something that Pasternak and Shelby hint at in the context of protest. But you could see the same kind of thing here, where there's like even symbolic resistance, even if it's not going to be successful, can be justified. Maybe it's even demanded by an obligation to uphold your human dignity or something like that. And so, right, you get this difficult case in protests that are not going to be successful, right? There's going to be cases where, you know, government's really repressive. Maybe the public is not responsive to a particular issue. And you know you're just not going to achieve success on this. What kind of resistance can you engage in? And one possibility is just that, I don't know, this gets tough. Anyways, what Shelby and Pasternak suggest is that perhaps in some cases, the mere act of resistance is not only demanded by dignity, but is a kind of success in and of itself, because that is the act of resistance. And this Pasternak puts this really nicely, is a way to experience freedom from domination in a way that might otherwise be unavailable. Like, so for some people in some situations, that might be the only way to experience freedom from domination from the state. I'm just going to throw that all out there. Good luck.
I had two, like, I had two reactions as you were saying that. Like, but and my first reaction, so I guess the first thing to say is I'm pretty sympathetic to that line, that if you even like the necessity can, in short, but I am sympathetic to the idea that the necessity condition is really not an actual condition, right? That there's a sense in which
the success condition,
that the success condition is a necessary condition for the reasons you just stated. At the same time, I want to go back to what I said like 2 hours ago, which was because I was anticipating this particular kind of like thought experiment, and I think it's just really messy and hard to evaluate how your current actions are contributing to success, right? And so, like, yeah, it's true. You might recognize there's no way we're going to achieve political change right now, but that doesn't mean that you're not doing anything to lay the foundations for political change at some point in the future. And so for these cases where it's like, yeah, there's no way that given the political landscape that I find myself in, anybody's going to change their mind, it doesn't immediately follow from that that you aren't contributing to the long-term success of your political goals.
No. We could stipulate a case where it doesn't. But I do want to point out if, you know, in the cases we're considering, if success is actually possible, it makes justifying the destruction easier.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
So if it can be justified in a case where there is no hope of success, it's going to be easier to justify in a case where there is a hope of success.
Yeah, yeah. No, from a philosophical... Yeah.
And crucially, in response to your earlier concern, I think for individual actors, right? Like, if you're an individual actor and you're pissed off about some injustice, you're frustrated, you have no other way of resisting and sort of expressing your resentment with the system other than engaging in acts of destruction. Presumably there's a class of people for whom that's true. And, you know, you can give this kind of dignity defense you know, spontaneous outbursts of violence and rioting might be justified in this way as an act of resistance or at least symbolic resistance.
I know it's an off topic example, but veganism and vegetarianism. Right, this is the most common argument you get as a vegetarian and or vegan, that you ought to give up on what you're doing because it's not going to bring about any change. Now, one defense of this goes the way that Michael's kind of sketched, which is, look, let's say it takes 10,000 people to reach the next... 10,000 people going vegetarian or vegan in order for the market to respond and, you know, feedlot animal animal abuse stuff to be affected, right, actually changed. Well, that's to, you're just the one, you're making us get so much closer to the next 10,000 that counts. But now you've just given me a whole new argument to give to people when they present me with this, which is like, look, you're asking me to undermine my self-dignity by continuing to eat meat and dairy products. For this simple utilitarian argument that it's not going to change the world. No, it's not going to change the world, but I'm standing up for what I believe in. It really matters to me that I do this. And it would be self-effacing and undermining.
All right, it's not quite that, right? Because it's
this is what I'm thinking about, right? And I'm thinking about the PETA violence, and I'm thinking about people, breaking fishing boats and destroying factory farms and... you know, releasing animals or doing other things to try to disrupt the animal abuse that is the meat industry. And nobody gives that a fair hearing.
So hold on, I think there's...
No, it's a very different case.
There's an important difference, but I think it actually raises a really interesting complication, which is I think this dignity defense, if you are going to give it, is at least much easier to be made when it's a person resisting... injustice, right? So it's not a mere standing up for what I believe in, right? Which is a good in and of itself, right? You should be able to do that. But in this case, right, in these cases, it's basic rights, it's deep injustice that you're protesting against. So dignity is undermined by those things. Now, what's interesting is if that argument is limited to those kinds of cases, then it does make things harder. Like, it's not easy to see how you can apply this justification for people who are championing even morally important causes if they're not fighting against some injustice which they are victims of, right? So it's different to be, and you can say, like, we have obligations to fight for justice and against injustice, and that seems true, but it's not clear that it's a matter of preserving your dignity in the same way it is for someone who is the victim of these injustices.
I don't know. This is gonna take us way too long. It's not clear to me. I'm not convinced of that. In part because we have social and cultural identities, right? And if you know, to go back to an injustice anywhere is, everywhere, right? So it is an affront to you to be complicit in a system that is systematically degrading, abusing, and murdering some portion of the population. You ought to stand up against that, even if you yourself are not subject to those risks. But I do agree that there's this complication when you are sort of one removed from, right? Certainly makes the self-defense argument hard to give when you are protesting and acting in ways on behalf of someone else. I will say that, like, it really depends on what your stance on animal rights is, because you can, some of those cases we literally are arguing for basic needs, right? Not being pumped full of hormones, not being, having your legs cut off so you don't scratch other people, right? I mean, like, I'm not going to get into it. It gets me way too emotional. But, that you might be able to give that same one removed defense of basic rights and needs argument in the animal case. Certainly, people are going to give that in the human case, right?
I do just want to make clear. So I think that's right. And arguments for self-defense, it's usually pretty easy to argue that if someone is being attacked and it's unjust and they can't protect themselves, that a third party can step in to protect them if, they can do so, meeting all the other usual mm-hmm. constraints. And this is kind of a fine-grained point, but... I just want to point out that the dignity argument, I think, is separate from these self-defense and mm-hmm. just war arguments. It's not a self-defense argument. Maybe it's like self-defense of dignity or something like that. But it's, I don't know. Yeah, maybe you can make that argument. You're like, look, if there's a group that their dignity is being threatened, you can
affirm their dignity. It's not that you can't.
Right, well, but
affirm their dignity by attacking innocent third parties. That's the hard part.
Well, so it's self-defense against dehumanization, right? And dehumanization is a harm. Does not have to be physical. Does not have to be bodily. So if somebody is seriously dehumanizing you by their treatment of you, by their enforcement of policies that ensure that you get entrenched in generational poverty and don't have access to opportunities, then that's a kind of self-defense argument. It's not self-defense the way we normally think about it, which is somebody running at you with a stick or trying to shoot you with a gun. But if they are treating you in ways that systematically dehumanize you and remove your humanity, then, as we know from Susie Kilmister, there can be deep connections between our concepts of human and humanity and our dignity. So I don't know. I think you can. It's maybe not the way we normally would get there, but that seems like a reasonable way to go.
The complicated this particular example just keeps getting more complicated, right?
Just drop the animal stuff, because I think that has so many other aspects of the complication. But I would, that was what I was thinking about when you're talking about numbers, you're talking about utilitarian, just don't care about
can
it.
Can I just say, this is great. Go ahead.
So, all right. So one more. So it seems right, the way you put it, that it is a form of self-defense, right? To think about the affirmation of you're doing it for the sake of affirming your dignity is a form of self-defense. That I can see the analogy there. Where it gets really weird is when you are the bystander acting on behalf of the other party, right? There's a sense in which there's this question just of like, how through your actions do you actually perform the defense on the other person's behalf? And the only way I could see it was if you are, what you're defending is that person's dignity, right? Like it's a self-defense of one's dignity, and you're acting on their behalf to protect their dignity, right? And the question is, how do you do this through engaging in violent action against somebody else? There is a sense in which that action can express or affirm your recognition of that party's humanity, right? And that it is a way of, it's a form of political expression.
So, like, look, interventionist military action just is intervening on behalf of the civilians or the minority parts of the population in some other country on behalf of them against their own government or militia groups or something like that. So if just war theory is going to enable it, there's going to be a similar line of defense
in
this case.
It's defense against the attacker. And I think what Michael is making me really remember is that crucial to the dignity part is like, you don't, so there are threats to dignity, and we can think about self-defense and protecting other people against attacks to dignity, but the particular dignity argument that's being made is it's the act of resistance, regardless of whether it's
exactly
succeed,
no, that's
that is right,
the you built into the we built into the scenario,
so
that there's
you can't
no success
do it for
possible,
someone else,
right? So the only thing that come the only good that can come from it is the dignity, the affirmation of the dignity part, right? That was the...
Well, then...
But we could go back to those just war justifications with the caveats that Michael registers. And I don't know what the standard view is about someone who, let's say, intentionally inflicts harm on an innocent civilian for a just cause, right? I mean, so we can still have that caveat and say... you can protect the dignity of other people, even if it's not the same thing, right? We do agree that it is a harm if your dignity is undermined, with the same kind of caveats, and collective action could be justified. So I think there is room for trying to extend that kind of argument, though it is a different argument than the sort of specific intrinsic good of dignity affirmation that we were talking about that is manifested in the act of resistance. There is a different interpretation of a dignity kind of argument, I think, which also would make it tough to extend, which is like, I could see someone thinking that like, there's kind of an ought implies can thing here. It's like when people's dignity is threatened, they inevitably will react violently or something like that. Or it's not possible to expect people not to engage in some kind of resistance, maybe violent resistance. And so you can't be held accountable.
I think that's the thing that has been different in the media coverage of this that I've heard. That's just different from the way in which previous protests have been covered. That particular line of thought, or at least something in the neighborhood of it, is something I've heard over and over again when people are talking about the violence that has occurred in these protests, where
it's like, how could you blame anyone for doing that?
When you are exposed to repeated traumas over and over again, how could you expect anybody to resist acting in the way that protesters have? There's a sense in which it's a flip. You know, people have basically acknowledged the point we're making about the King sort of impossible standard of, I've heard in the media, lots of people just say like, how could you expect anybody to be so saintly and not, you know, commit at least, you know, to engage in actions that are potentially destructive when you are being subjected to this sort of repeated trauma over and over?
Can I put in something that's just been in the back of my mind just the entire conversation, which, depending on how many weeks these podcasts have been coming out, I don't know, for the past 3 episodes? I don't know. Depends how you chop them up. And I just made it more complicated for myself. So the simple thought, the initial thought was this. I'm not going to... Okay, so I don't want to attach this to... though maybe... I don't know. Fuck. Anyway. There's a tendency within philosophy to take emotion to be not a means for persuasion, rational persuasion. For emotions to be the kinds of things that undermine reason giving, that undermine rational discussion, debate, and dialogue. And so we ought only try to engage in argument, and this would extend to these kinds of arguments talking about protest, in reasonable, rational ways by calmly expressing our reasons and not letting our emotions get in. Okay, so that's a little bit kind of fluffy philosophy of the real point, which is just, isn't it fucking bizarre how impermissible anger is in public? And also, here's the additional complication, the fuck are Americans getting on that boat for? You guys do so much emotion saturated through everything, like everything is so emotional, I really
that's
struggle.
That's what this is really about.
And
Hannah doesn't want to exchange pleasantries, she doesn't want to hug anyone, she doesn't want to shake your hand.
But like...
Just do the kiwi, yep, that'll do.
Yeah, right. Like, well, so it makes more sense. And like, you know, if you're like upper class British context, we're devoid of emotion, we don't express emotion in public kind of thing, right? It makes a little bit more sense. But the impermissibility of anger and politics and the ability to express anger and vent, right? It's just like, it's not okay. Sometimes you need that, right? Sometimes you just need to be able to throw something or, you know, engage in some like non-verbal means of expression because you've been so confined, because you've been so oppressed. And so part of this, like, it just feels so I don't know, like gentrified old British way of conducting political engagement that we all have to have a stiff upper lip and not engage in any emotion and stuff. Like, well, you know, that on its face, what a load of crap. Like, I see it comes up in philosophy and, like, you know, we have these arguments and you find people in philosophy challenging this idea that emotion can contribute, right, to reasonable, rational debate. It doesn't all have to be these completely devoid, colorless reasons. But, yeah, then also, what the hell are you guys doing? Like, you should be, like, this is, I'm crying because somebody put a star in front of me and I'm American. You know, why can't we have anger and emotion in this? Why does it have to be completely ripped out of a political action?
Just to be clear, just so viewers aren't, or listeners aren't confused, Michael, we've been justifying doing that, just so it's clear.
No, I know. I'm just like, I just like, that's so... What? We don't talk about anger as impossible.
Oh, so you're saying Americans have weird beliefs. Yeah, no, that's right. No, I agree. That's just, you're right. It's another strange incongruity.
So when the two of you first proposed this episode, I was worried... I have been worried about a comment I'd read on a Daily News thread when this issue first came up, where somebody had said basically I'm sick of people philosophizing these issues, right? And I think I was worried for precisely the reason that, or along the lines of what you're saying, Hannah, which is there's a sense in which the most persuasive thing to anybody that's come out of this event is just the raw emotion that comes from like witnessing horrible things happen to people. And I'm genuinely worried that the British comparison is perfect, right? Because it's like a group of people who are emotionally distanced, you know, more than pretty much anybody on the planet. And they are so because of precisely this acceptance of the sort of philosophical approach to reasoning through these issues that you were talking about.
Hang on, I'm confused. Was Hannah's complaint about standards of protest and opposition to emoting and engaging in destructive behavior? Because I thought it was that. But Michael, your concern is about us having this conversation
Concern is about the
intellectualizing
the idea, philosophical. I mean, one of the things she said, a bunch of things, but one of the things she said was that there is a sort of presupposition in philosophy that we should approach these things through sort of analytical reasoning, and that that's the way that you affect change, and that that's how we should sort of like
and
how we should digest and deal with these sorts of issues. Like, that's just an observation she made, and it's honestly, it was one of the underlying things that I was worried about when we talked about doing this episode, because there is a sense in which I fear that by doing analytic, there is a real critique of analytic philosophy, and that it has this distancing effect from the real substantive issues, because by doing the analysis, you do sort of distance yourself and naturally from the emotions. Now, it's not, you know, you can be an analytical person and still have empathy and sort of compartmentalize those things, but there is an interaction there, and like the comparison to the British just seems right, like that it's a mechanism for emotional distancing.
Yeah,
so I have a lot of things to say in response to that.
Yeah, this is a whole other conversation. But I mean, I've had similar thoughts as we've been recording. Like, we figuring out the fine grained details of what makes a protest action a legitimate one. Yeah, that's very Ivy Tower, Ivory Tower concern. What we ought to be doing is not sitting here; it's actually being out on the streets, engaging in the protest and trying to bring out change. And this is a slow, ineffective, very civil and sanitized and safe way to talk about the action, right? That's part of the conversation.
So if the critique is that we're cowardly, then I agree. I mean, the way you put it, Michael, is like, it's not a good way to affect change. Two responses to that. I don't think when we were doing this episode, our goal was to affect significant change. If that was our goal, we're stupid.
No, I agree. Probably. I 100% agree.
Now, maybe that should be our goal. And this is a question of like, you know, whether you should be more of an activist, perhaps, but we're cowardly. So, but then the other thing is, you know, this is the same old question. Right? And this came up with Susie Kilmister when we had her on, which is that if I'm going to defend the change angle, it's the ecosystem thing, which is like, first of all, not everyone's a good activist. Presumably, we fall. Hannah does not emote well enough. You made so uncomfortable. I am too. I just suck at like in public places, like There are other ways to do it. In any case, however. I don't think you can talk generally about what's effective and what's not. It depends on the people. And some people do want intellectual justifications. I suspect they're a small group and they're in the minority. But some people aren't sure and so do want reasons one way or the other. The other thing is, like, you can, like, so Michael, you said, you know, we can compartmentalize. We can talk about this analytically as we have and distance yourself from the emotional part. But, like, I don't get, like, during this conversation we are, but does that mean we're emotionally distant from this? I would think we're less emotionally distant from it than people who just don't care that much.
No, no.
Right,
yeah.
By engaging.
No, no, no. Like, I, that, yeah, yeah. No, not. It's not a, like, I mean, I'm on that. I'm doing the episode, Toby.
Like, we're both here. My point was more like, so that's in the background for me as well, right? So the, but it's separate, which is why it didn't really come up. I was more interested in the, just the impermissibility of public anger.
Right.
And how that as a norm already undercuts the possibility of, it doesn't even have to amount to violence, but shouting about.
No, I understood that to be your point. Michael was just projecting his insecurities. No,
but I think that's a really important part of the conversation too. It's just great. That this isn't a podcast about philosophy. So,
Michael, Jesus, stay on topic.
but I think it's important to bring that up because some people might dismiss this conversation as too analytic to be worthwhile. And I'm still on the fence there about that, in part because part of what we're trying to do is give, in terms of aims or goals, right, undercut this violence delegitimizes any act of protest argument, which is already at least trying to appear like it's engaging in reasons trading. So if you're going to give me the appearance of an argument that says any act of violence undermines the reason-giving force of your protest, then I'm going to respond to you in that kind of analytic mode. But there is this sort of
that's
separate...
a great fucking defense. We got to remember that one. You started it first. You engaged me in the analytical mode.
I like that. You fool. I like you that. You should have thrown something at me. Right?
I'm way too scared to do anything about that.
No, I would have caught it and then throw it like, cricket.
Play cricket, yeah.
But I just, this is one of the things that just through the whole recording I'm just thinking about is like, it's so limiting to us that
how
and I'm
improper
thinking, I'm thinking that, about like yeah just all these different contexts, but it's especially I think one of these white symptoms of the impropriety of emotion and emotional expression. And if it was more permissible to really let people know how something is affecting you and say it and not have to sanitize everything down to you're really violating my basic human rights. But you cut off my water. I have no water, right? Like very different rhetorical effects, but the effective in terms of persuasive, not the sort of abstract philosophical justification, reason giving kind of persuasive. That's completely off the table. We're not allowed to do that. And that's kind of a cultural hobbling
I'm
of
actually
protest movements.
Reminded of Bell Hooks's discussion of class in the classroom,
right,
which is talking about middle class white culture is this kind of like don't cause any problems, be quiet, be orderly, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. Transformative pedagogy is an area of research, talks about some of the cultural disenfranchisement that non-white students can feel when they're suddenly thrust into the Western education system, which conducts itself in a very culturally significant way and that may not be familiar to those students, and it immediately gets them off on the wrong track. Go back, what was it, 50 episodes to some of the educational inequality episodes, you can listen back there. But that's just another one of these it's another one of these levers that makes violence and protest or outrage and protest doesn't even have to amount to violence. People don't like it when people shout. People don't like it when people are screaming in unison. People like they really that's really unsettling.
Except at sporting events
and unless it's sport
or concerts.
Right, well, some concerts.
For unimportant things, for recreation, it's fun. The other thing, too, of course, and surely this has to be just the core response to, Michael, what you were saying, which is that, like, at least applied to the actual cases, some of these questions should be hard, and you shouldn't be sure, right? Like, we haven't emphasized this, but, like, we talk about, mere property destruction. But, as Michael, as you emphasized correctly in previous discussions, like, for lots of people, that will involve the destruction of their livelihood, right? That is a big deal for a lot of people. There are significant harms. Even when, we talk about, quote unquote, insignificant bodily harm, there can be lasting chronic injuries
PTSD.
That happen from that. Brain damage, God forbid, PTSD, of course. So this stuff is very serious, right? And of course, none of this questions the cause of the protest. The question is whether all means justify that end of the cause, and that we shouldn't be sure about. And we've given a sketch of cases where it does seem like, or at least avenues for justifying certain kinds of violent protests with significant limits. Again, like, it's relevant. Does it actually help the cause? And, you know, from our earlier discussion, we didn't really come back to this, but it seems very possible, if not plausible, that a certain degree of violence and destruction and protest can actually help a cause, contrary to what people typically think, just because it helps to grab attention, which seems crucial to acknowledging the legitimacy of the claims and actually caring enough to do something about it, which is the big thing, right? Overcoming the apathy and disinterest.
One kind of harm and violence that we haven't talked about at all is self-inflicted through things like hunger strikes and self-immolation, right? But we'll sort of, it's a different kind of topic. But hunger strikes are fairly widespread. And that's another way that you get sort of, interestingly, you don't see the same kind of violence delegitimizing kind of argument there. At least I haven't come across very much of it. But hunger strike and a protest is a self-inflicted violent kind of action, of deprivation, of denying to yourself your basic needs in order to show to somebody the seriousness of it.
That's one step further from King's sort of saintliness of accepting all harms to sort of inflicting harms just, you know, for the sake of forcing people to attend.
I don't know anything about the psychology of that phenomenon, but I imagine it's extremely interesting. This may sound very dark to say, but it's just sort of an interesting thing that happens.
I just can't. I have images of Buddhist monks self-immolating in my head that are. Yeah.
Okay. And I think at that point, we've probably reached a low point now. And we can wrap up this discussion, which has been really, really interesting, I think. A lot of difficult stuff here. A lot of difficult stuff. Is that grammatical?
I think so.
Difficult things?
You can have difficult stuff.
But can you have a lot of difficult stuff?
Like oobleck? The cornstarch and water non-Newtonian fluid, that's like it's a lot of difficult stuff. It's pretty hard to deal with.
All right, yeah, this is a lot like that. It's a lot like that. Anything more we have to say about this?
I'm sure, but I'm also sure that nobody wants to
probably
hear
best from us. Not. That's probably right. And I certainly don't want to edit any more than this. All right, well, thanks, guys, for that discussion. It's good to be back. All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for joining.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at @thebadlandspod. Thanks again for listening.